This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Notionally, Trump is supposed to be able to just fire anyone for any reason except for Federal Reserve Board of Governors. And the Trump lawyers looked at that and went, okay, so you're saying that we actually have to do it for cause with them? Oh, well, we'll come up with a cause. And if this counts for cause doesn't mean anything.
The Federal Reserve is supposed to be a non-political entity that, with a steady, measured hand, sets interest rates and economic policy in the United States. But as we're seeing time and time again under this current administration, absolutely nothing is sacred. If there are levers of power and reach, they will be tested by this authoritarian regime. This week on Sea Change Radio, the first half of our two-part conversation with Nathan Tankus, a journalist and the president of Notes on the Crises, who's been covering the Fed closely for many years. We hear about the history of the Federal Reserve, learn why its independence is pivotal, and discuss the recent attempts by the Trump administration to fire the Fed's first black woman governor, Lisa Cook, for the flimsiest of reasons. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Nathan Tankus. He is an author, a journalist, and the president of Notes on the Crises. Nathan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So you have been studying the Federal Reserve for many years, and it has kind of exploded onto the front page of newspapers. And it has recently been in the headlines again with Trump's attempted firing of Lisa Cook, the first black woman elected to the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. For our listeners, why don't you kind of give a quick summary of what the Federal Reserve has been and what sparked your interest in it?
So the Federal Reserve is the United States central bank. Central banks are an institution that exists in most, if not all, countries in the world. Our central bank was created by the Federal Reserve Act in 1913 and is called the Federal Reserve. Its modern form comes from the New Deal era, if not the New Deal itself, in 1935. This is one early major Federal Reserve leader referred to this as the Federal Reserve's Constitution, where the original Federal Reserve Act was its Articles of Confederation. And basically, the Federal Reserve structure exists today mostly in the way that it was constructed in 1935. So there is the Federal Reserve Board, where the president selects the governors. There are seven governors. They're supposed to have very long tenures to insulate them from presidential influence. That was the original congressional intent in 1935. And there's a committee that's related to the Federal Reserve Board called the Federal Open Market Committee, where all seven governors from the Board of Governors are on. And then additionally, there's a rotating set of quote-unquote presidents of what are called these Federal Reserve banks. So these are government-chartered corporations. They are, and you know, I'm just going to say this, and you can talk about this if you want, owned by the federal government as constructed by the 1935 Act, and their activities are directed and controlled by our government agencies, the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Open Market Committee. And so that's a lot of institutional detail. Its structure is complicated. The big picture is that the Federal Reserve is in charge of setting interest rates. They're in charge of, you know, so, you know, very, in a very real way, the interest rates that they change impact, for example, your credit card rates. They have an indirect impact on your mortgage rates and so on. And they also are a financial regulator. This is specifically the purview of the Federal Reserve Board. And so they, you know, for better or worse, they are a major part of our financial regulatory landscape. They're in charge of running the basics of the payment system. So, you know, the fact that you can clear checks or money, you can send money from one bank account or another, relies very fundamentally on the day-to-day activities of the Federal Reserve System. And so this structure, the big picture is the structure works the way it does in large degree because it's designed to be insulated from other parts of the federal government, particularly the president. So, you know, for example, the Federal Reserve determines its own budget. It can decide how much to spend money on certain things. It decides the salaries of its employees. So, you know, normally federal government employees are subject to, you know, a general system for how much federal employees are paid. Since it's the Federal Reserve's founding in 1913, it itself is exempt from those conditions. And the Federal Reserve banks, which are employers in their own right, you know, are not subject to those kinds of rules. So they have freedom over pay, they have freedom over their budget, and these kind of additional unique powers that, for the most part, no other government agency has, are the purpose of this whole structure is insulation. It's so that they don't have to go to Congress every year to make sure they get enough of a budget so they can keep on clearing the checks. And they don't, you know, they to try to insulate them from presidential interference and to let them kind of make policy, quote unquote, independently, whatever that may mean. And then that's the picture of today. I've been interested in this basically since 2008, the great financial crisis. I wanted to understand what was going on. I wanted to understand how the monetary system worked. I want to understand how things went wrong. And one way or another, that led me into getting very, very interested in the details of the Federal Reserve. And especially over the past 5 years, I've gotten especially interested in the legalities and the legal structure of the Federal Reserve and started engaging in a large project to issue Freedom of Information Act requests to the Federal Reserve, which is, let's say, done very infrequently, to uncover things that I thought were these important materials that other people hadn't really occurred to other people to try to get. And so that's, you know, that's what leads us to, so the current events, I'm someone who is, you know, on people's speed dial, so to speak, to talk about this topic.
And before we get to that current events, let's stay in the historical context. From 1935, that's an important date because that's kind of in the wake of the Great Depression. The country's just pulling itself out of the crash of 1929. And one of the most important parts of the Fed is its independence and its ability to not be swayed by market bubbles, market plunges, just to stay the course and to be filled with clear-eyed economists who don't have any loyalty to a particular president or a political party, but are trying to look at this from a very scientific, very pragmatic approach to viewing a country's monetary system. And it's been traditionally famously tight-lipped in the way the Fed communicates with the public. Alan Greenspan was a longtime Fed chair, and any kind of thing he said was taken as, you know, the word of God. Whenever Greenspan was speaking, it swayed markets one way or another. And so get us up to date with that through the first election of Donald Trump in 2016.
It's important to understand that in the 1930s, you know, as strange as this might sound, economists weren't particularly influential on monetary policy. Obviously, they had economists around, but the sort of idea now that, like, the central banking, that's economists' purview and they focus on it, was not the notion so much at the time. You know, the Federal Reserve, the main reason that the Federal Reserve Act that was reconstructed, that the Banking Act in 1935 happened, is that there was this Mormon banker who had kind of unorthodox ideas, something that would be more akin with, you know, progressive ideas around fiscal policy at the time. His name is Mariner Eccles. And he, you know, FDR wanted him to be chairman of the Fed. And basically, he said, only if I could restructure the Federal Reserve to make it a functional institution. You know, it was widely seen at the time to be dysfunctional, to be unresponsive to the Great Depression, to not be able to act quickly and with, you know, with flexibility. And it was seen as just like its structure just was not able to make national policy. You know, the monetary policy was much more decentralized, different regional central banks, the regional Federal Reserves were able to really make monetary policy in their own regions. And this was seen as kind of a cacophony. That's why, you know, the person I referred, referenced earlier, who was Emanuel Goldenweiser, who was head of research and statistics at the Federal Reserve from 1925 to 1946. So he's a very important foundational figure. Why he referred to the 35 Act as the Federal Reserve's constitution, as opposed to its Articles of Confederation, is precisely because the institution was seen as too decentralized, couldn't make decisions, and you needed to be reorganized in order to be functional. So that's the main impetus. I think the Federal Reserve structure, and I think this is very important to today in terms of long terms for governors, in terms of like especially trying to build in these protections of insulation from the president, comes essentially out of a compromise between like essentially the left wing of Congress versus the right wing. And the right wing at the time, you know, their big mark against FDR is that he's a dictator, you know, presidential supremacy, you know, that was the critique of FDR from the right, from traditional like 1930s conservatives. And, you know, just 3 months before that Banking Act of 1935 was passed was a foundational Supreme Court case called Humphrey's Executor that was precisely over FDR firing a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission and the Supreme Court coming down and saying that that firing was illegal. And so it was a landmark case that basically said that despite the fact that agencies are part of the executive branch, that the president doesn't have personal control over them. That if the Congress can pass an act that can say this person can only be removed for XYZ reasons, and that as actual a limitation on presidential power. So, you know, this sort of the insulation, what now gets posited and gets treated as an economist thing about central bank independence, I think was much more of a bread and butter issue of administrative law and a bread and butter issue of the separation of powers between the three branches of government. And over time, that original context has been forgotten up until we get to our moment today, which obviously we'll turn back to. You know, in terms of Trump, I think it's important to say that while Trump's actions in the second Trump administration on the Federal Reserve are far more extreme and rapid than what he was doing in his first term, which, you know, is the pattern across all of his activities over the last 7 months, I would say at the time, his actions were seen as pretty unprecedented, at least in terms of the norms that had formed. So, you know, for decades, it was kind of a norm to not criticize monetary policy openly. And Trump would not only criticize monetary policy openly, he would insult Powell, Jerome Powell, who was the chair of the Federal Reserve. Trump would insult him openly on Twitter. And this was seen as pretty remarkable. There was a lot of consternation and belief that the president was already influencing monetary policy more to his favor by the environment that he would create over interest rate increases or not lowering interest rate.
Working the refs, basically.
Yeah, working the refs. Now, of course, he did, despite what he claimed earlier this year, he did appoint Powell to the Federal Reserve. And so in that sense, he did follow the advice of the kind of, the mainstream business class who were speaking into his ear, just like he did on many other different policy points. And very clearly, that system of negotiating with Trump, of pushing Trump, of saying, oh, that wouldn't be good, that system has collapsed for the second Trump administration. Trump is angry. Trump wants revenge. Trump doesn't trust a lot of the people that he originally trusted because he didn't know what he wanted to do. And now he has a bunch of lackeys who have more government experience, who know much more, what wheels to turn, where the bodies are buried, so to speak. And so I think this, what's going on with the Fed, follows a larger pattern of, well, he now knows how to really fundamentally change things, and he wants to, and he's not afraid in the way that he might have been afraid in the first term of messing with things.
As I was walking down the street last night, a pretty little girl came into sight. I bowed and smiled and asked her name. She said, hold it, bud, I don't play that game. I reached in my pocket, and to her big surprise, that was Lincoln staring her dead in the eye.
On a greenback dollar bill, just a little piece of paper coated with chlorophyll.
She looked at me with that familiar desire. Eyes lit up like they were on fire. She said, my name's Flo and you're on the right track. Look here, Daddy, I wear furs on my back. So if you want to have fun in this man's land, let Lincoln and Jackson start shaking hands.
On a greenback dollar bill, just a little piece of paper coated with chlorophyll.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Nathan Tankus. He is a journalist, author, and president of Notes on the Crises. So, Nathan, let's turn to the firing, I guess that's the term, of Lisa Cook by President Trump. She is not resigning, and she is going to sue the government for this action. The basis of the firing, the cause, which is unprecedented, seems very flimsy. Why don't you explain?
Yes. So the Trump administration, and specifically the Federal Home Financing Authority, which is, it's a body that's supposed to regulate essentially like the federal housing lending industry. We'll just put it that way. There's things called the Federal Home Loan Banks and so on and so forth. We don't really have to get into the details of that now, but essentially the big picture is it's involved with the federal government's guaranteeing of mortgages and the providing of mortgages throughout the United States. And as a result, it has access to a ton of mortgage information. And it's currently, there's a Trump lackey who's currently at the head of it. And apparently, and unsurprisingly, the Trump administration sent this Trump lackey looking for dirt on Lisa Cook, who's the first Black woman appointed to the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors, and only the fourth Black person ever. And they allegedly dug up information that she applied for mortgages in two different places at different points of the same year, saying that they were her principal residences. And this term principal residences has been equated with this term primary residence, which is basically like the home that you're living in, especially a first home. And since you get more favorable mortgage rates on a loan for your primary residence, and Lisa Cook may have gotten two primary residence mortgages, although we don't actually know that. It's simply been claimed that there's been no evidence provided for that. The Trump administration is accusing her of mortgage fraud. Monday night, Trump posted a letter on Truth Social, basically directing to fire her for cause, where the cause is supposed to be this allegation of mortgage fraud, which has not been litigated in any court. It has not even been litigated. There's not even been a sort of internal federal government hearing. It's just a claim that a Trump apparatchik made, and they are moving forward with attempting to fire her and claiming that this is for cause. Just to say it straight out, this is illegal. You know, this for cause has supposed to be a due process, a due process situation. You're not supposed to be able to just remove someone. Nevertheless, the Trump administration has done this multiple times this year. And in the previous examples, specifically the Federal Trade Commission and also the National Labor Relations Board, people have been immediately locked out of their systems, their emails, of the buildings, and had to sue in their personal capacity to get their jobs back. And the Supreme Court, in its last major decision in this area, basically said that the America's long tradition of having Congress be able to limit the president's ability to fire someone from a government agency is null and void. In this case, you know, Wilcox v. Trump, that this came up. And out of nowhere, you know, kind of out of left field, in this case, knocking down that decision that I described earlier called Humphrey's Executor from 1935, so it's been 90 years, they randomly said, but this doesn't apply to the Fed, with no real justification, no real justification. So notionally, Trump is supposed to be able to just fire anyone for any reason except for Federal Reserve Board of Governors. And the Trump lawyers looked at that and went, okay, so you're saying that we actually have to do it for cause with them? Oh, well, we'll come up with a cause. And now they are seeking to legally test the Supreme Court on what they mean by for cause. And they're betting that the Supreme Court is either going to say, actually, psych, you can fire Federal Reserve Board of Governors, or that this counts as for cause. And if this counts as for cause doesn't mean anything. You just got to make up some stuff about a guy, you know. Alex likes to hang around children in parks. I don't need to come up with any evidence for that, but I'm firing you from this position because, hey, I just said this thing that disqualifies you.
Stop wasting my time. You know what I want. You know what I need. Oh, maybe you don't. Do I have to come right flat out and tell you everything? Give me some money.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Nathan Tankus. He's the president of Notes on the Crises. So, Nathan, there's been no connecting of the dots in terms of financial gain from what
Cook supposedly did. She listed a primary residence in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and also a primary residence in Atlanta for a condo. And you said, like, there could be some benefit depending on the interest rate variance, but I haven't been able to find that she's benefited financially from this supposed mortgage fraud. So if she's trying to commit mortgage fraud, she may have, you know, saved a few thousand dollars here or there on an interest rate. Whenever we see some kind of malfeasance with this Trump administration, there's always an element of projection. And it seemed pretty rich that Trump, who's a Florida resident when it suits him and a New York resident when it suits him, has decided that this is the line in the sand he must draw. And it's just, it's out of the ethical boundaries here that she would put a primary residence on two states.
Trump has been convicted of fraud for overvaluing his properties to get a lower interest rate because he would be less risky. I mean, like, he has been convicted of fraud, of felony fraud, for doing a thing much worse, much more extreme, and also actually doing it. Like, you know, Trump said in court that, like, the value of his properties fluctuates, you know, day to day with the weather. You know, it fluctuates with his own mood, in his own mind. He said that in court under oath. I mean, it's preposterous. It is completely preposterous for him to, you know, do it. And, like, it's just a pretext.
But I haven't seen any reference to that in any of this reporting of Cook. From even, like, the BBC reporting of it doesn't point out what you just pointed out.
Yeah, I think people see that as editorializing. But yeah, it's a basic fact. And of course, you know, the obvious needs to be stated. She's been targeted, not just being targeted for the Federal Reserve in general, she's been targeted in this specific way for being a Black woman. Like, you know, this country, the main and false narrative about the great financial crisis is essentially that, like, immigrants and Black people took out loans that they couldn't afford, and they defrauded the banks rather than the banks defrauded them. You know, there's a long history of pointing to the supposed financial malfeasance and fraud of Black women in this country. It's, you know, the central basis of the welfare queen myth. Like, you know, we'd be shirking our duty not to just say the obvious, which is she's being targeted not just in general, but in this way, with this allegation, in this sort of focus of maximal humiliation because she is a Black woman and because of the racial history behind this specific allegation in this country.
Tune in next week for the second half of our Sea Change Radio conversation with journalist Nathan Tankus.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Head Funk, Ray Charles, and Spinal Tap.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.